are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, November 12th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Mark Weibrot, Weisbrot, co-director with Dean Baker of the Center for Economic Policy Research in Washington, D.C., also the president of Just Foreign Policy, on the question of the coup or not coup in Bolivia. Also on the program today, DACA in front of the Supreme Court. And on the eve of public impeachment hearings, they're happening tomorrow, folks. Closed-door depositions reveal the Pentagon's questions about the Ukraine money holdup. Meanwhile, speaking of the Pentagon, U.S. military is monitoring interfaith groups opposed to child kidnappings at the border. Because, of course, it is. A new Gallup poll, this one not about the primary, this one shows that 34 million Americans lost a friend or family member in the past 5 years because they could not afford healthcare treatment. Meanwhile, Trump administration says the EPA will now purposely do less scientific and medical research to determine policy. Turkey is now assaulting civilians in northern Syria and threatening the EU if the EU levies sanctions. 11,000 scientists from 153 nations warn of untold suffering because of climate change. And lastly, in Roger Stone's ongoing perjury trial, Rick Gates says that Roger Stone had advanced knowledge of the WikiLeaks dumps. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, pleasure to have you here today. A lot of stuff going on. We have this Roger Stone trial, and where that goes largely is a decision of Nancy Pelosi's, oddly enough. There's a lot of stuff that's coming down in that trial that I think could be further grounds for impeachment if the Democrats decide to pursue that. It does not look like that's what they're going to do. But tomorrow they will be presenting the first of public testimony. Reports are that they are very sensitive to the idea that folks can't follow this, that people don't like to watch long series anymore. They just want to see the first hour of the show. And so that's the way it's going to be designed. Starting at 10 a.m. tomorrow, we're going to be doing a live stream. We will break and then just go back into the show. Don't know what we're going to do on the show tomorrow. May just cover some news stories, which is the original plan. May continue on with the testimony, depending on what's going on. But as soon as the hearings start, we'll be live, so you can check us out. For today, we will be talking to Mark Weisbrot about what's going on in Bolivia, just in terms of the American intervention. Because, you know, frankly, I've gotten a lot of emails from Bolivians, from folks who are married to a Bolivian and who take issue with the idea that this was a coup in Bolivia. And it's very difficult it's very difficult from, Organization of American States just came out with a report as to voting irregularities. Very difficult to be sitting here in the United States and assess the voting irregularities of what's going on in Bolivia. It's very hard to do that, to sit here in Brooklyn and assess the voting irregularities that are going on in Georgia. In fact, it's also very difficult to be sitting in the state of Georgia and assess the voting irregularities in Georgia. I mean, this goes for everywhere. I don't mean to single out Georgia, although that's one of the most obvious cases.
It happens here too.
It happens here too as well. People forget there are two counties just around New York City, including parts of New York City, that were formerly under pre-clearance provisions of the Voting Rights Act because of problems in the past with voting discrepancies. I want to talk to Mark Weisbrod about this to get at the very least to get people up to date as to the sort of the TikToks and the issues in Bolivia. I can tell you that and maybe we should pull some of that footage. Do we have the footage of the masked military guys bringing in election officials? That's usually a sign that maybe this isn't the most democratic of processes. But we will get there. In the meantime, Nomi Const is with us today. Hello, Nomi.
Hello.
And she's going to be with us through the show into the fun half of the program. Michael is taking an extended vacation to California. I'm not 100% sure. I think he's going to be on some TYT shows and who knows what else out there. But Nomi is here with us, as is, of course, Jamie and Matt and Brendan.
What's up?
And we will get into all this. All right, let's start with this. This is not the first time that Joe Biden has said stuff like this. Nomi, I think, as you're aware. And I will renew the renewal of my call for something specific from reporters after we play this clip. This is a presidential town hall. When did this happen? Like two nights ago? Last night.
Are they still doing these?
It is pretty stunning that it garners no attention from anybody, because there's no one who seems to be genuinely interested in Joe Biden. And every time that we hear somebody is contemplating jumping into the race, whether it's Bloomberg or Deval Patrick or, I don't know, Oprah or whomever it is, That is specifically a vote of no confidence of Joe Biden.
Right.
I mean, that's exactly what it is. And because these are people who are afraid that Bernie Sanders will win. Maybe they're afraid that Elizabeth Warren will win. They're afraid that Joe Biden's going to lose.
Right.
Here is Joe Biden on CNN Town Hall last night.
With Trump out of the way.
Oh, pause it. I'm sorry. The question is, you were a senator during the impeachment probes of Nixon and Clinton. That's not the question. The question is, why do you think you're going to be able to deal with the Republicans when you have, chuckle, chuckle, defeated Donald Trump?
With Trump out of the way, I predict you. Now, my 89 opponents who are running for the nomination are going to say something different. But let me just say, I honest to God believe with Trump out of the way, you're going to find people screwing up a lot more courage than they had before to say, okay, I can cooperate. I can move now. I have more leeway. Because look what he does. You got Jeff Sessions in Alabama saying, please don't say anything negative about me, Mr. President. Please don't say anything negative. I know you don't like me. Come on. This is just... The politics has gotten just so out of whack, but it's going to come back and whack.
Very, very hard to assess whether the politics will come back and whack.
I want that on a shirt.
But let's just start with this. 2009, Politico reports on June 1st, 2009, what was it, June? Oh, I'm sorry, excuse me. June 1st, 2012, President Obama told supporters that he expected the gridlock to end after the election when Republicans could stop worrying about voting him out of office. The fever will break. They said this They said this after 2010, too. Now they've got some power. Now they're going to have to deal with it. They've been saying this over and over again. But here's my question. When Joe Biden says that, aside from being deluded, why is no one asking him, why do you think you can do this better than Barack Obama? Mm. Because Donald Trump was not there when Mitch McConnell said, we're not going to hold hearings for Merrick Garland. Donald Trump was not there when Mitch McConnell said, we're not going to seat any of your judges. We're not going to allow any nominations. All the obstruction. We're not going to even support the idea that Barack Obama wants to cut Social Security. We're not even going to take yes for an answer. Why has no one asked him that?
Because it's his good friend, Jeff Sessions. He served in the Senate with him for 30 or however many years. You know, this is the guy who would reach across the aisle and have a beer with the Republican. He can have a real conversation. I bet you that's his message.
But then why didn't he do it when Obama was president? He was going to save that?
Of course. I mean, you and I both know that. But
right.
That's their messaging.
This seems to me to be a great question for a reporter to ask, because I think it takes about three questions before he gets to having to say, well, because I'm white.
Don't forget, Michael Bloomberg will be the one who can do it. That is his message. No, come on. I mean, that is. It's ultimately because he's white. I mean, that's the ultimate.
That's the, you know, is that
Barack
the subtext?
Obama. The subtext here is, if you want to win back white America, go with Joe Biden, who won Barack Obama white America.
Right.
White working class America.
I mean, that's certainly, I think, why Obama picked him.
Right.
And now, of course, we should be clear, that was a 12-year younger, a 13-year younger Joe Biden, mm-hmm. who wasn't looking to whack in when the government returns, or what is he? He's going to whack back.
Politics of whack.
He's going to
come back and whack.
Well, look, Bernie had Back in Black at his rally,
that's
right?
True.
So
that's
maybe Biden, he's got Back in Whack.
Back in Whack.
Which is like white black. I think that's what he's saying.
Oh, I see. Yeah. It all comes clear. Oh, I see. Now, actually, that makes sense for the first time.
it takes a genius like me to figure out how Joe Biden speaks.
Do you think Bloomberg is going to jump into the race?
I mean, he's been... The criticism of the last couple of days it didn't stay on Twitter. It really picked up by mainstream media. I mean, when the New York Times talks about Bloomberg getting criticized, I don't know. I mean, he's bored, clearly. If he's there to be a spoiler for the left, I don't even think that's the case, actually. I think that they're actually concerned. You know, they probably think they have the Democratic primary, because the truth is Joe Biden is doing well in the polls still, despite all of this.
Right.
I mean, it's the people watching CNN town halls who are the ones being polled. And we don't know how that's going to, you know, play out in New Hampshire and Iowa, because they're not closed primary states. In closed primary states, you know, the Democratic establishment does well. So, OK, Joe Biden becomes a nominee and he gets ruined by Donald Trump. I think that's his take, is he's the only one who can beat Trump in his mind.
But are we seeing all these people jump in, or at least starting to wonder about it, because they're all afraid that Biden's going to not only not win in Iowa and New Hampshire. Right. I mean, he's leading in the polls,
right.
But it's pretty precarious lead, it seems like. And if he comes in third, yeah, or fourth, because Pete Buttigieg is now in third place. It is now Biden, Warren, and right. Buttigieg,
God.
And then Sanders in these polls. Now, these are, you know, that I don't think that's the average of the polls. These are just the most recent polls. Mm-hmm. And who knows? And I say that with the caveat that Sanders' theory of the campaign is to reach voters who may not show up in the polling. We can't test that proposition
like anybody
until
under 40.
Right. We can't test that proposition until the actual election. But there seems to be a fear that Biden could lose badly enough in New Hampshire and mm-hmm. in Iowa mm-hmm. that he begins to crumble in South Carolina. Right. And then it's Johnny ball game for him.
Or he has no money to do that.
Right.
I think they're playing it safe. Like, you know, the business industry likes to have bets on all the ponies, not just, you know, one. So part of it is they're setting up. They just set up a super PAC for Joe Biden, you know, to run ads for him, because it seems like he only had four donors and they all maxed out. And so now they're going to take the rest of their money and put it in a super PAC. I think having Deval Patrick is a little bit of the magic of the magical thinking of the Obama coalition, or the Obama map of 2008. because they're still attached to that idea.
Right. And there's so many people out there looking for a Bain Capital, for a, exactly. you know, a hedge fund guy.
A guy who made money off of the right. homeowners crisis.
Right.
And of course, you know, Bloomberg, it's the billionaire thing. Like, I'm a better billionaire than you. Like, people love Michael Bloomberg, you know, somebody who believes in democracy so much so that he had to extend his own term here and, you know, stop and frisk. There's a legacy of destruction that he's caused that's left in this city. Income inequality, oligarchs dumping their cash in real estate, driving it up for everybody else. This, he's not going to do well in the Democratic primary. But I think the bet is if Biden cannot take it to South Carolina because he doesn't have the money and the primaries aren't closed, that there are other paths to victory, including Pete Buttigieg. Although I don't think that the establishment thinks Pete right. can beat Trump.
Right.
And ultimately they're thinking, how can we make money off the next presidency? Because right now we're not making enough money off the right. presidency.
So are you saying that Bloomberg's running in the Democratic primary, to the extent that he does, is really trying to set up a third party run?
I mean, if
or just like a pull the you know, emergency cord type
emergency of situation. Cord situation, he could run for third. I mean, if
so far it doesn't make sense to me.
If Sanders wins,
yep.
And I think, you know, I think the whole thing about Warren, the billionaires being afraid of Warren. I think billionaires on TV are afraid of Warren. Billionaires who are operating in the Democratic Party primary process of dumping money into candidates. I don't think they're actually afraid of her. You know, the second Soros money goes into, you know, the Warren campaign, that's like a signal that she plays well with us.
Right. All right. Well, we will get to more on that later. But support for today's show comes from Third Love. Third Love designs bras with breast size and shape in mind for a perfect fit and premium feel.
Are you selling this?
I did. It's true. We have a now it's not my personal testimonial. We have a specific bra tester on the show, and this is what she had to say. I like that they don't have a zillion options, so it's easy to choose something quickly. The fit is great. I usually have to return most bras I order online, even though they're in my size. I ordered two. Both fit. That almost never happens. Super comfortable for an everyday bra, but not as boring as most t-shirt bras. Subtle, cute details so I don't feel basic. Folks, I've been told this is hands down the most comfortable bra you'll own. Straps that won't slip, tagless labels, not to mention lightweight. It's got super thin memory foam cups to mold your shape. Every customer has 60 days to put their bra to test. And if you don't love it, check this out. This is actually, you're going to be impressed by this. You return it. Third Love will wash it and donate it to a woman in need.
Oh.
Supporting charities in their local San Francisco Bay Area and across the United States. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone, so they're offering my listeners 15% off your first order.
I'm sold.
There you go. Go to thirdlove.com/majority now to find your perfect fitting bra. Get 15% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/majority. For 15% off today. This is also going to interest you. I don't know if you know this about me, Nomi, but I'm very, very, I become very, very specific and picky about dental hygiene.
Oh.
Yeah.
Is that because you're aging?
It is because I'm aging.
Just kidding.
It is. It's true, actually. And my dentist was like, you got to get on the ball here. What do you think is the number one, the best thing about a toothbrush? Like, what is the most important thing about a toothbrush?
Flexibility.
That's a good answer, but you're wrong.
Okay.
It is using it.
Oh Jesus.
Yeah, it's very basic. But if you ask your dentist, they will tell you it's less about the actual toothbrush and more about the habit of using it. Now, with that said, electric toothbrushes that vibrate are best. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about that. But this is what makes Quip so special. Quip's got the sensitive vibrations. It's got a built-in timer,
So
it basically tells you 30 seconds here, 30 seconds here, 30 seconds here. It's got pulses in between, gives you the dentist recommended 2 minutes. Sometimes I'll do four. I'm not going to lie.
Overachiever here.
It's true. Quip automatically delivers the brush heads to you every 3 months because people don't change their toothbrush enough. Bingo, right? It gives you clean new bristles right on schedule. And it is not like one of those big, bulky electric toothbrush. It's designed like a regular toothbrush. And it has a travel cap that doubles as a mirror mount as well. So the bottom line is, it's not a situation where you put it on your small sink like you have in New York City, and it falls over, and then it falls on the floor, and you don't want to use it anymore. This is very handy. You can travel with it. And the bottom line is, you end up brushing on a regular basis, and that's what you need to do. That is what is done for me. I gave one to my sister. Her dentist said to her to thank me.
Wow.
Yeah. That is a
now,
true
Now, do you have female
story.
Testimonial of the vibrating toothbrush, too?
No, I don't. That okay. is all mine. Actually, my entire family.
Did I go there?
You did.
I was waiting to see how.
Well, listen, Quip starts at just $25. You'll get your first refill free at getquip.com/majority. They send it to you every 3 months, so you don't have to worry about it. Simple way to support the show and to start brushing better. Now's the time to start, Nomi. I'm not trying to say anything.
Please don't zoom in here.
But you have to go to getquip.com/majority to get your first refill free. All right, folks, quick break. When we come back, Mark Weisbrot on what's going on in Bolivia. We'll be right back.
Nobody move, there's blood on the floor. And I can't find my heart. Where did it go? Did I leave it in the cold? So please give it back, cause it's not yours to take. It must have been when I lost my mind. Deep in the cup, drowning in its pain. Somebody help, cause I can't find my way. Nobody move.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Mark Weisbrot. He is an economist and columnist, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. His latest is in The Nation magazine, The Trump Administration Undercutting Democracy in Bolivia. The subtitle, Will the U.S. and the Organization of American States Once Again Be Able to Overturn Election Results? Mark, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So, all right. Now, Mark, there's a lot of controversy over how to characterize what took place in Bolivia over the past couple of days. Let's go back and sort of provide everybody with sort of a timeline as to what's been going on, because I started the show by saying this, that, we've been characterizing it as a coup. One of my, I guess, maxims is when, the military personnel have to wear, baklavas, when they go on TV, bringing out election officials, that's a good sign that this is not a democratic process. I've had some pushback from listeners who are Bolivian or have family or relatives in Bolivia. But let's start with just sort of give us the timeline of what has taken place with Evo Morales.
Yes, in terms of the coup, it's kind of funny. I was talking to one of the major broadcast TV stations in the U.S., I won't say which one, yesterday. And she said she talked to two people who said it wasn't a coup. I said, well, you don't really have to bother with those people because, I mean, this was a coup. The president, you know, the head of the armed forces told the president and vice president to resign. And then they did. I said, what did they have to do? Stick a gun in his face? I mean, this was a military coup, and there isn't any doubt about it at all. And in terms of,
I mean,
of
do we know that they didn't? Frankly, I mean, you know.
Stick it, oh, yeah. I think we probably would have heard that if right. they actually pointed the gun at them. But they didn't have to. I mean, you know, there are so many ways they can kill them or just let a mob kill them if they wanted to. I mean, there's been right-wing violence in that country. The right wing tried to overthrow the government in 2009 violently. And so, they told to leave. And Evo is now reportedly on his way to Mexico, where he's been offered asylum. So the headline on that Nation article was kind of an understatement. It's all done now. And Trump has now issued, the White House issued a statement yesterday supporting the coup and saying that it was bringing democracy to, it was a very Orwellian statement, saying it's bringing democracy. But you want a timeline from the election, October 20th?
Well, let's even go before then, because part of the argument that this is not a coup was because people have perceived Morales as undemocratically becoming president for the fourth time, I guess. And so just walk us back from the beginning of Morales' ascent.
Okay, well, he was elected in 2005. And how much time do we have?
Because we got plenty of time.
Oh, okay, great. All right, well, he was elected in 2005 and took office in 2006. And I went down there, actually, in 2005. And it was very interesting because I met with him and his ministers. And first thing I asked the ministers is, what's going to happen? You've been under IMF agreements for 20 straight years now. And what's going to happen now? And he said, oh, well, you know, the IMF was here. They offered us a new standby arrangement. And we said no. And they offered us a poverty reduction growth facility loan. And we said no. And when I said, and we said, no, thanks. We don't need it. I said, well, what about all your other aid that you get? You know, they got grants from Europe because they're the poorest country in South America. And he said, well, they said that wouldn't be dependent on that anymore. So they really made a major break. And for those, you know, at that moment when I was talking to them, that economy, the income per person in that economy, when Evo took office, this is the most basic measure that economists have of economic well-being, is just income per person, not even looking at distribution, okay? And it had not grown for 27 years, 20 of those under the IMF agreement. So this was a major break, okay? That's the first thing. And then they've done very well since then. They've been the fastest growing. They've grown twice as fast as Latin America since 2000 in terms of income per person since 2006. Since Evo took office, they reduced poverty by 42% and extreme poverty by 60%. And these are all official numbers that are accepted by, you know, the IMF, the World Bank, the UN. These are not just, you know, somebody's numbers. Okay, so this is why he's popular still and was able to get 47% of the vote, even with, you know, almost all the media against him.
All right. Well, I want to go through the changes in the Constitution in some respects he pushed through. I mean, my understanding is that the controversy surrounding him was that he entered into office. He did not serve a full term the first time around because of when the election was held. He then served for two more consecutive terms. At that time, the Constitution said that two was the limit there was a referendum. I mean, this is just the history as I know it. You tell me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
There was a referendum that narrowly defeated an amendment to the Constitution to change that. He went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court of Bolivia found that the term limits were was unconstitutional, sort of ignoring or overturning the referendum, as it were, and opening the door for him to run for re-election. Then that takes us up to this election that he wins, as you say, 47% to 37% or so.
36.5.
If you have less than 40%, there needs to be a runoff. He avoided a runoff. There was a...
The rule... Okay, there's two rules for the avoiding the runoff. One is if you get a majority outright, over 50, then you don't have a runoff. The second is if you get over 40%, and you beat the second runner-up by more than 10 percentage points, then there's no runoff. Okay. So he made that with 10.6.
Okay. And so we also now have the OAS, the Organization of American States, came out with an initial report saying that there were voting irregularities. And this is what your piece discusses. Give us your assessment of their assessment.
Okay. I want to put a little more detail. But before, I just want to mention one other thing that I should have mentioned from the beginning, is that Evo Morales is the first indigenous president in the country, and really, you know, pretty much in the whole Latin America for 500 years. But it's particular in Bolivia because it has the largest indigenous percentage of the population in the Americas. And this is a big thing because, you know, indigenous people were very much marginalized and excluded, and they made a disproportionate amount of progress that I describe in terms of the economic progress that the country has made since he took office. But, okay, so back to the election and the OAS. So the OAS put out a press statement right after the election, the day after, and it said, and I'm going to have to go into some detail here because,
please,
you know, most of your listeners think, if they're reading the press, they think this election was stolen. That's the impression you get from the media, even though most of the media doesn't say that outright. Okay, so the OAS puts out a press release right after the election, and they state their, quote, deep concern and surprise at the drastic and hard to explain change in the trend of the preliminary results that were being reported. Okay, so this one sentence, which they repeated two more times in their preliminary report, and then something like it in their latest audit, the preliminary audit that they just did, which Evo invited them in the country to do. This is the Organization of States Electoral Observation Mission. And they're supposed to be professionals, and they're supposed to do a clean observation. And they're never, ever supposed to put out a press release right after the election implying, as they did, that there's something wrong with the vote count when they do not have one shred of evidence for that. That's
in other words,
they
just hadn't done the analysis. It was more
they
like...
hadn't done any analysis whatsoever, okay. And they said this. Now, let's take a look at what they were talking about, because we did the statistical analysis. And, you know, if you look at the press, it's very interesting. Like, there's all these articles, you know, they're all over the press that have the same theme. And the theme is that there was this vote count that was being reported, and then all of a sudden, the vote count stopped after 84%. This is what they're talking about here in that one sentence. It stopped after at 84% of the votes tallied. And then it came back, and Evo's margin increased. And increased enough that when 95% of the votes were reported, he was just over the 10% margin. Now, this is the fundamental basis of the entire getting rid of them, because they're all yelling about fraud in the streets. You have the New York Times even saying this. You know, although they had an article just 2 days ago where they had to remove two false statements from the article, and they didn't put a correction there, but they had two false statements about exactly this. Okay, so all the media is getting this wrong, and I don't do media criticism. Okay, so I'm not going to trash anybody for how bad this report is, because you know the reporters don't have time to look at numbers, and they think the OAS is a reliable source, and that's probably because they don't know the history of its, you know, electoral observation in this hemisphere. But nonetheless, they just took their word for this. They're expressing concern, and it kind of looks funny, right? He's only got 7 points, and he needs 10, and then he gets 10 after this interruption. Now let's see what really happened, okay? What really happened is this count that they're referring to, and it's the only count they refer to in the media, is not the official vote count. It's called a quick count. It's something that's done only, and it was actually originally instituted, I think, at the request of the OAS. It's something that's done to keep people informed of what's going on with the count before the official count can be done, because that takes longer, okay? It's just they take basically screenshots of the results at intervals and they post them. Now, this count is not the official count. It's not binding. It's not doesn't have the same rules. It doesn't determine the result of the election. And it's the only vote count you'll see discussed in the media, because I think most of the reporters don't even know this, you know? And so this count, sorry to go into the detail,
no,
but this count was never promised to go to 100%. And it never did in the past elections. It stopped around 70, okay? So they stopped at 84% because, you know, they were done. And there was nothing really that surprising about it. And the OAS observation mission knows this. And here's the most important thing. There's literally no concern or surprise that anybody who can do eighth grade arithmetic and read a graph, let alone a statistical analysis, should express at the fact that AVO's margin increased exactly as much as it did. Why? Because it wasn't a jump, as it looks like to you in the media. It wasn't a jump from the 84%, from the first 84% to the count at 95% of the votes. It was a continuation of a gradual trend that was going on almost the whole time. And what was the cause of this gradual trend? It's completely visible in the data to anyone who looks at it. And it's all on the web. 34,000 data points from all the tally sheets, okay? And if you look at the data, what you see is that AVO, what we all knew, AVO gets much more support from areas that are rural and poor.
Right.
And those come in later. And they were coming in later the whole time.
That dynamic, it's frankly not too dissimilar from ones that we have in this country.
Oh, of course. And how many times have you analogous watched the election
results? Well, Kashema Swant, let's just say, as one. Or Chesa Boudin. The count of those who had, I guess, mailed in their ballots tends to run more progressive. Those get counted later. That's why the rate of the votes that they pick up. And there's a similar dynamic with rural counties in this country where you hear stuff from New Hampshire coming from the remote parts or, you know, wherever it is. I mean, this is not an unheard of dynamic.
Nobody denies this.
Okay.
Nobody denies this. You know, we've had our report out. I just tweeted out all this stuff that I'm talking about. And it was, you know, it went out to 4,600 retweets, and it's all over the place. And, you know, all of these reporters have seen it. Like I said, the New York Times ran two corrections already. They all know this. Nobody's reported it. And I think that is kind of disgraceful because, you know, they have people at the New York Times. They have Nate Silver. They can go to anybody in their
Nate
own.
Cone. To be fair. You had the wrong Nate. But yes.
Oh yeah, they have Nate Cohn, but they had, that's right, they don't have Nate Silver anymore. They used to.
All right, that's true. Right. But let's, so Mark, let me ask you this. So I'm looking at a report from the OAS right now. This is the Secretariat for Strengthening Democracy, the Department of Electoral Cooperation Observation. It's the Electoral Integrity Analysis, General Elections of the Plurinational State of Bolivia, October 20th, 2019, preliminary findings. Is what you've just discussed to us, is that what I'm looking at in this report? Because it has the electoral results transmission system in the preliminary findings. It has...
How long is this one? Because there's two that they put out.
This one here is the 13-page one.
Yeah, that it's called Preliminary Report.
Yeah, and this one is a 13-1. It gives an...
Actually, if it's in English, it has to be the preliminary report because they haven't come out with the audit report in English yet. Yeah, I read that. Yeah.
Well, okay, so with all this said, there's these questions. Now, Morales, then there was massive protests in Bolivia.
Yeah.
Right? We had hundreds of thousands, if not over a million people come out and protest, in my understanding.
Yeah, its country is polarized. As I said, they tried to overthrow the government in 2009
and
with the right wing. Yeah,
Morales agrees to a revote. Is that right?
He did do that because, and this, I, you know, you could say it was a mistake for him to invite the OAS to do this audit after they had already lied twice about this. But he did it. And he said when he invited them to do this last audit that if they found anything wrong, that he would have a new election. And so he kept his promise. But the right, of course, the opposition, they weren't going for a new election anymore. They wanted a coup. And so they didn't care that he was willing to have a new election. They wanted him out. And, you know, the rule of law, who cares, right? I mean, he's still the only legitimate president, because no matter what you think of this election, you can think that it was a total farce, whatever you want to say. And again, there hasn't been any evidence yet of any stealing or vote fraud. But, you know, even if you don't believe it at all, he's still the president until December or something. And because he was democratically elected and there's no new president. And
in other words, his existing term does not end until December.
That's right. December 22nd, I think. And so he is the president of the country and the military ran him out of the country. So this is a classic military coup, and the reluctance of so much of the media to even call it that. But even worse, you know, the endorsement of it by the president of the United States. I mean, you know, even when George W. Bush had the CIA overthrow the president of Haiti in 1991, he denounced the coup,
right?
Because and he, you know, put sanctions on the dictatorship that they had actually paid people to install. So because it just wasn't acceptable to support a military coup against a democratically elected government. So we've descended a little bit since then,
right?
In terms of what the media is willing to tolerate, especially.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, regardless, you could stipulate that the election was corrupted. He agreed to have another election. You could stipulate that he forced the Supreme Court to rule in his favor by.
Well, he didn't, though. They just ruled.
Of course.
I mean, that's like saying Bush v. Gore was forced by the Republicans. You can disagree with the decision. And I personally have a different view of term limits than a lot of the media. So we can talk about that if you want to. On the substance, you know, I don't really believe in term limits. You don't have them. You know, Angela Merkel has been in office longer than Evo. And, you know, they seem to think it's okay for European countries, but not for developing countries who, you know, which, you know, obviously there's a certain amount of racism here. But
but either way, the bottom line is the guy was president under any circumstance until December.
Yeah.
And the military's come in wearing ski masks and, you know, have said, you got to leave. That is just not a democratic process. There's no way one could argue that this has been.
Well, I hate
a democratic
to say this
process.
Because I really don't like to do media criticism. But the New York Times has an editorial, which is the first one in 17 years like this, that endorses the coup.
Is this really their first time that they've endorsed a coup? Because it feels like it's not.
It's the first one in 17 years. And the last one they did it was in 2002. And they walked back from it. It was on a Friday. And they walked back from it on the following Tuesday because they realized it was real. And they said it was wrong.
So let's talk a little bit about the potential reasons why we are getting. And like I say, right, like you know, I've gotten emails from people who say my wife and I live in we're in Singapore, but somehow she voted for Evo at her polling location in La Paz. My old co-worker's dead father. Now, I don't know who this is from. I don't know if it's true, but I'm going to stipulate all of these things. The bottom line is the guy's term doesn't end till December. We can't, if Donald Trump, God willing, loses the election in November of 2020, we can't have the military come in and remove him from office and say that this is part of the democratic process. I mean, this is fairly straightforward stuff, it seems to me.
It should be, yeah. I think it's really, yeah, it's really terrible.
So let's talk about the reasons why this might happen. I mean, some of the things have been suggested to me is one of the things is, I mean, on top of the fact that we have a history, the DEA, as early as, this is according to a piece in the HuffPo by Ryan Grimm and Nick Wing from some time ago. I don't have the exact date with me, but this, according to them, in 2008, after the Morales expelled the DEA from Bolivia, they started their own strategy of beginning to target Morales in a drug sting at the time. So there's been a history of U.S. government, attempts to get rid of Morales. Obviously, the U.S. government's attempt to get rid of Latin American leaders is longer than I've been alive. But with that said, my understanding is the other recently Morales made a move to nationalize the lithium mining business. And of course, lithium rather important for batteries and all of our technologies. What else? What other interests?
Well, this is something I've been writing about for 20 years, so I can talk about this as long as you want. I mean,
please.
You know, in the 21st century, there was a major change in Latin America. For the first time, I think, you know, and other people have said this, in 500 years, it became independent. You had very independent left governments were elected that governed over the majority of the people in Latin America, in, you know, Argentina and Brazil and Venezuela and Bolivia, Ecuador, Uruguay, Paraguay, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Honduras. So this was really a new and different thing. They couldn't really do this in the past for exactly the reasons that we're seeing right now when they tried. You know, in fact, a lot of these people didn't want to run for office because they were still looking at, they didn't think it was possible. The last time they elected a left president in 1973, for example, or 1970 in Chile, he was overthrown with the help of the United States. And so they didn't, but then once people started doing it and people realized they could vote and actually elect a president, they would stay there. And, you know, there was enormous progress during this period, by the way, from 2003 to 2013, you had poverty fell from, the poverty rate in Latin America fell from 44 to 28% after having risen for the prior 20 years, actually having gone up. So you had a huge economic failure from 1980 to 2000, and that produced this wave of left governments. And, you know, I don't want to oversimplify, but I would say it's not really an exaggeration to say that the U.S. policy under both the Bush and Obama administrations was a policy of containment and rollback. And they got rid of whatever governments they could. They did that coup in Honduras. I mean, they supported the coup in Honduras in 2009. Hillary Clinton wrote in her memoirs that as Secretary of State, she she actually worked, and she worked within the OAS too, to make sure that the democratically elected president could not come back to the country. And so, and I could go through all of these countries, in almost every one of these countries, the United States has done something to harm or undermine, or in a few cases, get rid of these democratically elected governments. You know, all the time you want, we can pick a country.
Right.
I'll tell you what they did.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, folks are at least a little bit well versed on that history around these parts. But in terms of the OAS, give us an example of why we should. I mean, obviously, the preliminary results are preliminary, and they, you know, one piece of evidence that they may have been predisposed to finding a specific, you know, answer in regard to these elections. And I should say, again, even if we stipulate that the OAS was correct in finding irregularities, we've already heard that, I mean, they're there under the auspices of Morales to a certain extent. He allowed it in, them in. He welcomed them in. He has agreed to a reelection to run this again. And so, I mean, in some respects, it's sort of moot whatever they found or what their predispositions are. But we've seen evidence of their predispositions. What other examples do you have of the OAS looking at voting an election and claiming irregularities when it turns out there were and look, there's irregularities, I would imagine, in every election. I certainly think there is in this country.
Yes.
But
yes,
I mean, ones that are material enough to change the outcome. What can you point us to for folks who want to dig a little deeper into this?
Yes. Well, first of all, you know, if you just anybody wants to just go to my Twitter feed, the pinned tweet at the top has all of the work we've done on recently in on Bolivia, including the elections. And we did a statistical analysis of this latest election, even though I said, as I said, the quick count is not the official count, it's the one that the media is using. So it was very easy statistically to show that you could predict the last 16% of votes that came, that were reported, or last 11% in the quick count, but either one. The remaining votes, you could predict them on the basis of the 84% of votes that came before the interruption, because it was the same trend. So it's a very it's a simple statistical analysis. So So what is the main question here?
Well, the main question was just sort of where else do we see an example of the OAS coming in?
Oh, yes, yes. Okay, I did write about that, and there are links in the Nation article. But the two that we investigated, and especially the last one where we did statistical analysis, was the 2011 Haitian election, where the OAS did something that electoral observers never do. They came in, they set up a commission within the OAS to look at this election, the first round of the presidential election in Haiti, which took place in 2010, and the report was issued in 2011. And they looked at it, and they were to, you know, to make some recommendation. And they overturned the result of the election without any statistical analysis or a recount. And it was completely political. In fact, I was on a panel with the head statistician. He was a former head of the American Statistical Association, and he admitted straight out that it was a political decision. And so that was outrageous. And the U.S. government actually pressured Haiti, threatening to withhold desperately needed post-earthquake aid. Remember the earthquake in 2010 that devastated the country, unless they accepted what the OAS decided for their election. Now, that didn't destroy the country as badly as what they did in 2000. In 2000, there was an election, and President Aristide, who was the one that was overthrown in 1991, was running, and he won by a large majority with a very large turnout. And they couldn't. And then the OAS initially issued a report saying the election was good, was very good. And then they got the word, apparently, because then they changed that. And they complained, and they couldn't complain about the presidential part of it because it was too big of a margin. So they went for these Senate races, and they discredited the election on that basis. And that became the theme in every media article, not just then, but for the next 4 years. This was the dispute between the government and the opposition of Haiti was the results of the parliamentary part, the Senate part of this election. And this was reported in the media the way what I'm talking about right now, you know, in Bolivia. They really made it look like the government stole something. And this was used to cut off all international aid to Haiti during this, almost all, really virtually all, because it was all U.S. allies, you know, France and Canada. They were all in it. They all wanted to get rid of this president. And because they'd already gotten rid of him in 91, he wasn't supposed to come back. And so they did this, and they really starved the country and made a mess out of it. And then in 2004, they had a coup, which was, of course, you know, supported by the United States. And a plane, according to Aristide and witnesses, that was a U.S. plane, one of those rendition planes, actually, took him out of the country to Africa. And he was in exile for 7 years. And so that was really, I have to blame the OAS a lot for that, because if they hadn't changed their report, they would not have, the U.S. would not have been able to have at least that major pretext for delegitimizing the government and working towards this coup for 4 years. And this is a, you know, there's a lot of actual record on this. So it isn't, you know, speculation.
Right.
For example, there was a very good article in the New York Times that showed from U.S. You know, government sources, officials, that at the same time when the president of Haiti was having this fight with the opposition over the elections, that and he was trying to negotiate with them. He was willing to, you know, make compromises. And they were telling the opposition not to give in, that not to make any agreement with him, that we're going to get rid of this this government. So, and that's how the coup happened. And that country has been politically destroyed since
right.
then. And that was really, so I think those were two very serious offenses by the OAS. And I think if some of the journalists knew this history, they wouldn't just take the OAS you know, statements as the word of God, especially with Trump and Rubio openly supporting this coup and leaning on the OAS to do what they want.
Well, Mark Weisbrot, we appreciate your time today. I mean, you know, I think at the very least, the idea that this has been a democratic response to something that people say is anti-democratic is laughable. And the reporting on this has been, I think, you know, pretty atrocious, because there's no doubt in my mind that people who've been following this, at least to some extent, have far more information than they did. I really appreciate your time today. And we will put a link to that piece in The Nation magazine at majority.fm. Thanks again for your
time. Thanks very much.
All right, folks. There you have it. I mean, I think, you know, obviously there's a lot of controversy. Different people, it's highly polarized there, and different people have different perspectives on Evo Morales. And that's certainly their prerogative. But as much as I have an issue with Donald Trump, the idea of hooded Marines marching Mick Mulvaney, and as much as I might actually sort of fantasize about this in some ways, marching Mick Mulvaney out in front of, you know, video cameras, I just don't think that that would be considered democratic in any way. And I know there are those who say that, well, when we see a CIA member as a whistleblower, and we see all of these national security people corroborate this story that Trump withheld things and this is leading to impeachment, that is also not a coup, because impeachment is specifically called for in the Constitution. And it is a political process. It is not a criminal process. There is nothing in the Constitution that outlines to what degree one must engage in criminality to be impeached. All it takes is convincing X numbers of, you know, the majority of members of the House and then a two-thirds majority in the Senate to impeach and convict. And so to equate these things would be ridiculous and disingenuous. That's just the reality of it. Maybe politics, but once you resort to having the military come in with hoods on their heads and drive a president who, even if you believe, should not have had an opportunity to run for re-election, is still the sitting president out of your country, I think you got a problem there. And, you know, we look at all the problems that we have in terms of, you know, the supposed hordes of immigrants who are coming up in caravans from these various countries in Central America, largely because these countries have been completely destabilized over the course of the 20th century because of our intervention of one sort or another. And just as I don't want other countries intervening in our elections and our leadership, I don't want us to do the same in these other countries. And, you know, whether it's, you know, because we're funding, you know, groups in these countries, or whether it's simply because we, you know, push an organization to use its supposed credibility to undercut the legitimacy of the order in specific countries. So that's that. And now we head to the fun half. But after I tell you this, well, first off, this show relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.co, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Nomi, have you started listening to the AM Quickie yet?
I have once.
Well, that's all right.
First off, I'm very impressed that you're able to do it, because...
Well, I do it part of the time, and Lucy Steiner voices it the other part of the time, and then we have an AI bot that produces it and puts it together every morning, and it took a long time to perfect that thing.
Andrew Yang would be proud of you.
Yes, very proud, and runs on lithium batteries. So, but folks can sign up for the AM Quickie at amquickie.com. You can also access it through your app. If you have the Majority app, refresh it, update it. It's been updated for Android and for iOS in the past, like, 24 hours. Apparently, if you have a Motorola phone from some time ago, it may be a problematic. Apparently, Android is the worst thing to develop for.
Motorola is Android? No.
Motorola phones run on an Android sort of a browser operating system, I should say. And there's so many different pieces of hardware and so many different versions of Android operating system that it seems to be impossible to get it straight.
I kind of want to go back to – I want to be that place in my
life. Flip phone?
Yeah. But also, like, just – I just want a device – it's called the iPod, maybe, where you just put all of your podcasts. That's all I want. That's all I want my phone for, is to be able to carry podcasts around and have a flip phone. Over it all. I'm over the tracking. I've read Edward Snowden's book. I'm, like, deep in this space of, like, stop it. Just stop owning me. I'm over it.
Well, that's the problem with technology, right? I mean, I'm on my phone, like, I'd say about 98% of the day.
I watched a mini documentary last night on the addiction. I mean, we all know about the addiction,
right?
But there are it's mostly young men who are going to these rehab centers, and it's insane what they're going through. I mean, how it's caused stress, increased heart attacks, and liver dysfunction, and they go through why all this happens. And it blew my mind because, you know, as I'm sitting there watching this, I'm on my phone. I'm, like, looking up everything about it. I can't even leave my phone in the other room at night because I'll watch TV, which I'm also addicted to. And I'm like, oh, let me look that up. They just referenced this thing in this blah, blah, blah.
Oh, yeah. My phone addiction is definitely battling my burgeoning nicotine addiction right now. But at this point, if I have a choice between plugging in my iPhone to charge and plugging in my Juul, I will plug in my phone first.
Oh, all right. Well, that's good.
You won't have the choice.
I mean, kind of. It also is disturbing because nicotine, as we know, is very addictive. So whatever's happening in my brain,
I don't know if
with
you
the
heard,
phone is probably bad.
Heard the interview I did with an attorney down in Vegas about Juul. I don't think you were here that day.
I don't want to know.
Three times the nicotine that's in a cigarette.
No, I know.
I mean, that's why it's good.
Super.
Wait, how
addictive.
Is that? Isn't it supposed to get you off of it? Is it per dose? Like, are you supposed to do less? I don't understand.
It's like
this.
Better for you.
It's supposed
than
to get you
cigarettes,
stop smoking.
But
yeah,
then except
you,
for
then you smoke way more without even thinking about it because it's just vapor and you
and
can
then,
do it in your house.
And then you're locked into a proprietary technology.
Right.
Well, also you don't know what those chemicals are. So we'll talk to you in 20 years. Let's. It's one of those.
Yeah,
jobs.
Better the devil you know than the devil you don't know. I have a friend who still smokes who says that to me.
There you go. Folks, you've heard me talk about LifeLock. It's a pioneer in identity theft protection. Now Norton, a pioneer in consumer cybersecurity, has joined forces with LifeLock to help protect your cyber safety. A Norton 360 with LifeLock membership provides you all-in-one protection. If there's an identity theft problem, they have specialists who will work to fix it. No one can prevent all cybercrime and identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. But Norton 360 with LifeLock is a powerful ally for your cyber safety. Until December 8th, that's just a little bit less than a month away, sign up and get a special Majority Report offer. Save up to 40% off your first year by going to Norton.com/majority. That's 40% off Norton 360 with LifeLock at Norton.com/majority. Do you want to plug Matriarch?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Why don't you do that?
Thank you. That's
and then we'll
nice
go into
you.
The fun half.
So I'm very excited to be part of this new organization called Matriarch. At this point, it's over 36 women who have come together, progressive women, leaders, some are former elected officials, current elected officials, who run for office like myself, and they're activists and labor organizers and labor leaders. We've come together to start an organization called Matriarch, which is the duty, the sole purpose is to support working class progressive candidates running for Congress, women. This is a space that hasn't been filled. There's a lot of organizations out there. There are a lot of female-aligned organizations with different missions out there on the Democratic side. But there was a need to support working-class candidates who, number one, are running on a platform of economic justice, who understand that to empower women, women who are on the front lines of injustice in this country, especially women of color, especially immigrant women, you have to support them. And it also recognizes that there are more women than ever who are running for office who don't have the tools. What that means is, you know, when you are running, as I have, you got to raise money. Maybe you don't have to raise as much money as like the centrists do because they have to reward all their friends, but you have to raise enough money to exist. And it's as much as I would love to donate directly just to campaigns all the time, having institutional support, having organizations endorse you, having, you know, the press cover you. The press doesn't cover you if you don't get endorsements, if you don't raise enough money. So having an organization that supports you early on in your race is extremely powerful. I mean, admittedly, like our campaign would not have been able to get off the ground if you were not plugging the campaign all the time, Sam. Like we would not have been able to raise enough money to exist if I didn't have friends who were willing to have my back. And, you know, at that point, because of the election, there weren't many organizations right. or, you know, unions involved. But they won't even look at you as a candidate if you don't raise $200,000, $150,000, $300,000.
This is sort of like the dilemma, like you can't get a job working at a good restaurant as a waiter unless you have a good experience working at a restaurant as a waiter.
Right.
And so somebody needs to give you a break. And that happens if you're wealthy, like you say, and you have your own cash, you have your own sort of network of wealthy friends to get you into that next tier, or if you have corporate buddies and that's it. And we that's need right. as progressives to develop our own systems right. of finding those people and of supporting those people so they can rise enough to where they are considered viable enough for other people to contribute.
That's right, because it's not, I mean, we're not going up against any institutions. A lot of times you'll see candidates who weren't progressive, and then they do get to the point where they raise $300,000 based on a miracle, because that's really what it takes, is maybe there's a story that breaks or a video that goes viral, but that's not the norm. And so we want to help these candidates get to that level where other organizations come in and they're forced to go left, where their opponents, who are probably more conservative, you know, may not be able to sustain their own campaigns. You know, the way to win is to have our own ecosystem. And so Matriarch is a political action committee. The goal is to help them financially, but also help them with, like, the infrastructure. We have an amazing board of advisors that's going to be offering support. We're raising money right now so that we have the organization actually has the infrastructure to help candidates with press, help candidates with messaging, help candidates with trainings, a different type of training that's not focused solely on fundraising, but on getting your message out, creating your narrative, telling the story of your community. It doesn't fully exist in this context, and definitely doesn't exist for women at this point, especially focused on economic justice. So we would love your support. We are starting up right now. So if you want to go to matriarchpack.com, please, you know, chip in a few bucks. It goes a long way right now. And hopefully, you know, that money, if we get to the point where we can support candidates pretty soon, we're going to be unveiling our endorsements in the next few weeks. And we would like to support the first slate of candidates.
We'll put a link to that in today's podcast description. Jamie.
Oh, yeah. This week on the Antifada, Sean is joined by two of his fellow tradesmen, John Torney and Billy O'Connor. Yes, that is his real name. He is a real iron worker from New Jersey, and he's really a Marxist, and he should have his own show, I think. So they do a little workers' inquiry on themselves. They discuss their own work histories and how they became radicalized through historical events as well as their experiences on the job. They poke holes in the J.D. Vance white working class mythos that sees cultural regression, not material factors, as the wellspring of Trumpism. And they talk about the structures they've encountered in their particular unions and how the working class might overcome the provincialism and conservatism of business unionism, which, as we all know, is a real problem. Also, there is a bonus for our patrons if you want even more Billy O'Connor, where Sean and Billy talk about some classic on-the-job stories, stories about jobs they've worked, stories about organizing, and a really crazy story about why you should never organize alone, especially in Louisiana, because they will literally murder you and leave your body in a swamp for the alligators.
Whoa.
Nice. Matt.
Yeah, coming up on Literary Hangover this week for members and on Saturday for everybody is Afra Ben and her story Orinoco or the Royal Slave. Afra Ben is a feminist Tory monarchist propagandist spy who was also the first.
It's like a quadruple threat.
Yeah, she was also the first professional playwright in England. A woman, you should say. There were men, but.
That's what it takes in show business. You got to have a lot of different. You got to have a lot of different skill sets.
Tap dance backwards.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 238. 56, 27, one half, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up. Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.